My particular discipline within that specialty is hyperbaric medicine and diving medicine and obviously hyperbaric oxygen treatment. And I'm more interested in inflammatory conditions, and particularly those that involve the brain, because brain inflammation can be triggered by nothing more than a head injury.
So how is it that changing the oxygen concentration can affect the disease?
Well, oxygen controls inflammation, and when tissue is damaged, and it doesn't matter whether it's damaged by infection or by direct injury, the damage affects the capillaries within the tissue, and that means that they get swollen and they leak some agents from blood, which set up an inflammatory process. And so the recovery from that is oxygen dependent. And obviously we get a specific dose from the air, but sometimes that's not the optimum dose and we need some more.
So what do you do to give more?
Okay, well, obviously we can increase the amount of oxygen we breathe from 21%, which is in air, up to 100%, whatever the prevailing barometric pressure is. But to give a higher dose, we've got to use a pressure vessel, otherwise known as a hyperbaric chamber.
Now, is that a common treatment for brain injury?
Well, it isn't as yet, but there are a lot of studies going on in the United States at the moment of using this for veterans from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and treating their brain injury, because many of these veterans get a chronic form of brain injury, and the studies are now showing that this actually can benefit from being given more oxygen. Basically, it's extending the envelope of recovery. You know, no one would deny that breathing is essential to getting better. Obviously, if you stop breathing, you don't exist. But we forget that breathing is necessary to get better when we're sick, whether it be an infection or an injury. And so what we're doing is actually improving that level of recovery by actually improving breathing.
Making sure that all cells, wherever they are in the body, get sufficient oxygen.
Yes, to the best of our ability. And obviously, the cells operate in a fairly narrow range of oxygen concentrations. And unfortunately, none of the disease processes result in any elevation of the oxygen level. They all reduce it. And so if we give more oxygen through the lungs, then we can actually correct that deficit. We may not be able to if the blood supply in the affected tissue is damaged, but in general we can actually optimise the delivery of oxygen to correct a deficit.
Now, you showed a very horrific photograph of a young woman who was injured when a plane exploded right above her and she was very badly burned. And she made what seemed to be a miraculous recovery within just a few days. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was near Christmas in 1985, and as you say, this light aircraft crashed on the shopping mall, and obviously she was burnt by the cascading gasoline fuel, aviation fuel. And so she sustained a second degree burn that looked as if it was likely to go to third degree, which means that the skin then sloughs off and that requires grafting. But the unit she was treated in actually had a hyperbaric chamber run by a colleague and friend, Dr. Paul Cianci, and he obviously allowed me permission to use his slides. And this is how burns should be managed. And so there are some units in the United States that do use oxygen in this way for burns patients. But the greatest problem is that we don't teach this methodology in medical schools. That means that doctors can qualify without understanding how to use oxygen as a treatment. They will learn how to use oxygen as a supplement to ensure that hemoglobin is saturated, but they don't learn how to extend that dimension to using oxygen as a treatment. And if you say to a lay person, does the brain need oxygen? Obviously they'll look at you as if you're crazy. But if you say, this patient has had an injury and an area of the brain doesn't have enough oxygen, what do you think we need to give? And I think most people would say we need to give some more oxygen. And so that's exactly the logic that underpins using this treatment. And of course, we now have amazingly sophisticated imaging systems. And I showed the use of magnetic resonance spectroscopy to show ATP levels in a newborn infant.
So that baby was damaged at birth?
Yes, yes. The baby exhibited signs of neurological problems and so was followed up from birth. And its ATP levels were still a third of what they should be 35 days post-delivery. And even though we've used this technology, and ATP, of course, is dependent on oxygen, nobody says, can we do anything about it by actually improving oxygen delivery? And it's because it's not taught in medical school. And I explained in my talk how we overlook the fact that during delivery, with the compression of the head, the blood flow through the brain can reduce, and then when it's restored, we get this phenomenon called reperfusion injury. And reperfusion injury involves neutrophils and signaling of neutrophils to actually invade the area. And unfortunately, this is the signaling they use for infection. They release the same free radicals that they do for infection, and so they exacerbate the damage. And reperfusion injury was first described in transplanted organs, particularly the heart. And it was found that if the period a heart was removed from the body extended beyond about 3 hours, or certainly 4 hours, when blood supply was re-established in the recipient of the donor organ, they measured the blood coming out and found evidence of damage to the heart. And a huge amount of research was done in the 1970s and 80s, which implicated this phenomenon of reperfusion injury. And so the dependence of this on oxygen and the need to give a very high dose of oxygen has now been very well established, because it downregulates the adhesion of neutrophils and prevents their sequestration into the tissue. And so if you can prevent the neutrophils invading the tissue, you avoid reperfusion injury. And so we have a fundamental problem that we ignore barometric pressure and we ignore oxygen used as a treatment.
Well, I guess that the oxygen story is the reason you were invited to this meeting.
That's perfectly true. As I explained in my first slide, when I read the interview in the UK, a journalist interviewed Paul Davis, and then I looked up the paper that he and Charlie Lineweaver had written. It was a PDF file, and I simply did a search for oxygen in their paper, and it wasn't there. And then I did a search for hypoxia, and that wasn't there either. So I thought maybe it's worth contacting them to say that this ancient cassette of genes is actually controlled by changing oxygen levels. And that led, obviously, to eventually an invitation here.
And what have you been thinking about this meeting so far? Have you learnt anything?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, there have been some fabulous presentations. The molecular aspects and the biochemistry are obviously very complex, but there have been a number of issues that have come up. And of course, one of the key ones is the role of neutrophils in metastasis of cancer. And that's particularly fascinating because it's something that I'd anticipated on, I guess, theoretical grounds, because they're a unique cell, because they can migrate within the vasculature with no connection, no actual physical connection to any other cell. So they actually have an independent existence within the circulation. And that's very unique. You probably know that red blood cells don't have a nucleus. And so they're not strictly a cell at all. They're a capsule containing hemoglobin. They have a lot of structures which are part of their formation. But having extruded the nucleus, red cells can't reproduce. But on the other hand, the neutrophil has all the complements of a proper cell. And so it's very, very unique.
So you've enjoyed yourself?
I have enjoyed it very much indeed. It's been a delightful meeting, delightful people, and a delightful environment.